Welcome to the Kindlings Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, this is Dick Staub back with you. We're talking tonight about the five films nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards for 2006. Babel, The Departed, Letters from Iwo Jima, Little Miss Sunshine, and The Queen. And our panel tonight includes Jeffrey Overstreet. His newest book is Through a Screen Darkly. You can order that at Amazon.com and see a really cool picture of him there under Amazon Connect, that author profile thing. Also, Stefan Olstein is with us, and Jenny Spohr, and we're having an interesting conversation. One of the issues that I got into, quite a debate with one of our panelists. There was a guy on the panel in New York that was the guy that took Tommy Hilfiger global, and strung out on cocaine, had a religious spiritual experience, came back to faith, and has ended up pretty precocious intellectually, but also pretty conservative. And he was trashing Sundance Film Festival. And which, you know, is easy to do if you pick out the few films that are getting all the press among conservatives. And I was arguing that the best films that you will see in a year are the indie films, because these are people that are passionate, that care about their film. They've mortgaged their house. They've written a story they care about. They've gotten the best actors they could. And they're unknown actors who want to do great work still, because they don't have an entourage and people getting their food and doing their hair and all that stuff. And you just see great films there. But it's not that you can't see great films in Hollywood. It's just that Hollywood is totally an economic calculus. It's an exception for a really great independent film, for instance, to make its way into the system. And actually, the next film that we're talking about, we'll talk about whether it's a great film or not, but it certainly fits the Hollywood mold. I mean, it went in with an incredible cast. It went in with Martin Scorsese and a big budget, and everybody expected it to be Academy Award stuff from the minute it started being made, because it's the Hollywood product. It's got all the names, it's got all the promotion, it's got all the... So when we think about the messages and the meaning and the theology that we see in The Departed, Jack Nicholson has a line early on in the movie where he says, "When I was your age, they would say you could become cops or criminals. What I'm saying is, when you're facing a loaded gun, what's the difference?" There's this kind of cynical undertone to this whole film. What do you guys, and Jenny, see in The Departed?
Thank you.
Well, I think cynical is a good word. But I also think that it's easy to overlook one, there are no quiet characters in The Departed. But one of the not-so-loud characters in The Departed is Martin Sheen's character, the head of that police department. And you've got gangsters who are lying and deceitful, and you've got cops who are lying and deceitful, and then you've got good cops who have to become lying and deceitful in order to do good, and you've got really, really bad gangsters who lie and deceive people into thinking that they are good in order to do bad. And Martin Sheen's character, interesting, I think the only character in the film that gives any kind of indication that he's religious. Mm-hmm. You know, since there are a few people here who haven't seen it, I won't say too much, but there's a key choice.
We kind of know that we're going to have to do spoilers, because there's so many people that haven't seen so many of the films.
I think I can safely generally say that he makes a very big choice late in the film that is Christ-like. And... yes. It's easy to forget that in all the hubbub that follows and the chaos that follows.
Well, there are a lot of quiet characters in the film because they're all dead by the end of the film.
Exactly.
So, hence the title.
Hence The Departed.
It's like the, you know, how do you know Jack Bauer's been to Mars? Because there's no people there, you know? He killed them all. So what else do you see in The Departed?
You know, it's interesting, Jeffrey, that you bring that character up, because I felt Costello, who's Jack Nicholson's character, was as well the only other sort of quote-unquote true character in the film. He's this horrible guy. He's a horrible gangster, kills people, but he doesn't pretend not to be. Everybody else is pretending to be something else. Even the woman in the film who's the romantic lead is lying and is asked by DiCaprio, "Well, do you lie?" And she eventually sort of says, "Well, yeah, of course, you know, I lied." The psychiatrist, this. So interesting that Nicholson and then Sheen are the only sort of true, honest characters in the entire film.
So what makes this a great film?
Well, technically, great performances. Dialogue that just snaps, crackles, and pops. And the story, well, it's been imported, so that's why it's great.
It was a
movie called Infernal Affairs that was fantastic and much leaner, meaner version of the story.
Yeah.
But, you know, if that's the Hollywood way. You take an independent film from another country and dress it up.
What does this film say about the human condition?
Well, what I see is it's an extreme version of what we all do. You know, like I'm a teacher and I'm a writer. But, you know, you have to make compromises. And everybody makes compromises, and this is just taken right to the bitter end. Everybody compromises about everything.
Do you feel that's where the central story was wanting to take us? Is it a morality tale?
Yeah, I think it's we're to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. So what do you do if you're Leonardo DiCaprio's character in this film, and it's your job to go undercover and make yourself as wicked, you know, all evidence saying that you're as wicked as you, as they are, but your motives are pure. How do you do that without compromising, without losing some of your soul in the process? And that's his conflict.
And you can't. It seemed to throw Ecclesiastes at it, which I like to do with a lot of films because they seem to fit into that. It seems that we're told that life is vanity. That whole quote about at the end of a loaded gun, it doesn't matter. You're getting shot. You're dead. You're the departed. That life is vanity. Tomorrow we're going to die, so eat, drink, be merry, live like you want to.
So is there any hope in this film?
I think it's something that's consistent in Martin Scorsese's film. You know, he grew up very religious. I believe he was an altar boy, wasn't he?
Yeah, I went to seminary.
Yeah. And his next film, by the way, is Endo's book Silence, which is as profoundly
great film,
conflicted spiritually as it gets.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see that happen. But all of his films are about where is God? I tend to think he believes he's there, but he is showing us in a mirror, look at how bad it's getting. Tell me, can you find God in here?
So back to the Sheen character. He's representing a more morally upright person.
Maybe a glimmer.
Except, you know, he sets all of this stuff in motion. Mm-hmm. I mean, he goes home and has a nice dinner with his wife, but he's the guy who's putting everybody undercover. See, the way I see this is kind of an Old Testament film. Like, to me, the Old Testament is a pretty miserable book. I don't know if you ever saw the X-rated Bible, where the American Atheist Association pulled out all the naughty bits, you know, and it's about 300 pages of just horrible stuff. No, I mean, really, it's just awful. Everybody gets raped and murdered. But when you get to the New Testament, it really is good news. I mean, if you've really read the Old Testament, and then you read the Gospel, you go, oh, good, you know, something's going to happen here.
Yep.
And that's where I think Scorsese takes us in a lot of his films, is he takes us to that Old Testament vision, but he never sees the hope.
But see, what's really interesting is that what both of these first two films are saying is this is life when you've given up hope. It's a post-Christian. Yes. It's back to a pre-Christian. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of bad stuff, and there's no hope. We'd love to believe there's hope, but where is it?
Yeah, but Sheen is a father figure to the DiCaprio character. He puts his son on the altar, so to speak. And when it comes down to it, he can't let the knife fall, and he steps in himself. And I think that there's a faint echo there of the father putting himself on the line.
Except he doesn't think he doesn't realize what's going to happen to him either.
Yeah, because he's also being entrapped.
He makes a sign of the cross and turns and faces them. I don't know if he knows how far it's going to go, but he knows it's going to be bad.
Okay, to keep moving, because our audience is eager to get in this and tell us the right answers, let's go to letters from Iwo Jima.
My name is Clint Eastwood. I need an editor. That's what I have to say about even his Oscar speech last night. Clint, carry one with you. I just wondered why he made this film. I feel the point has been said, war is hell, and we're all human, you know, American, Japanese, German alike, and so let's not kill each other. It was, you know, beautiful, if a little long, but I just didn't see it as far as the
the heft that it brought or the new thing it said into the world of war films.
What is the morality? What is the theme? What is the belief system of this film?
Well, to me, it's the death rattle of this old, you know, Meiji Restoration thing where everybody in Japan is a warrior. And all of a sudden, you know, it's one thing to die in a cause. Like if you died at Pearl Harbor, you'd say, I died sinking the American fleet. Well, these guys are going to die because they're dying. I mean, they're dying because they want to prolong, you know, the ultimate defeat another day. And it's just so hopeless. And yet you see guys who realize this. You know, there's a, what's the one guy, Saito, who just, you know, he's digging holes and everything, and he realizes there's something really wrong here. He's not buying into this total worldview that he's supposed to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're groping for some way to die with honor in the middle of this, and they're not finding it. Yeah. And it's just tragic to watch the people who grasp that, and it's really troubling to watch the people who buy into it and end up just, you know, killing themselves, thinking that's the best way out.
But see, one of the things that's really interesting about this is in Japan, there's a quality you have of not seeing things. So like, you know, if you walk in and somebody's in the bathroom, you don't see them. So when they come out of the bathroom, you go, hi, long time no see. And none of these guys, the Japanese actors, knew about Iwo Jima. You know, it's too painful. So in Japanese history books, you just don't see it. And in that sense, it was interesting. I wonder how it's going to be in Japan when people have to really look at this and see the totality of this futile gesture. Because, you know, Japan is probably the least spiritual country in the world.
But if you take it as a companion piece to Flag of Our Fathers, one of the reviewers said that his basic point is life or death, heroism or folly. It all comes down to which side you're on, which piece of ground you're occupying in any given moment in the battle, and every soldier on the ground is expendable. Mm-hmm. Kind of whether you're, whichever war you're in, the story is really the same.
Yeah, and I thought he I thought he made that point over and over and over again to the point where, I mean, there were so much mirroring going on between the two films of people getting in the same kind of moral dilemmas, and you see the worst in one person and the best in another. And frankly, I got a little tired of the idea that the American forces and the Japanese forces were basically the same, because when I read stories about the Japanese army and what they were capable of and what great numbers of them did, that kind of atrocity is not what you hear about when you read about the American army. You read about isolated cases of soldiers doing terrible things, and that always happens. Those situations.
Isolated bombs that took out a whole city, though.
But the rape of Nanking, and there were things going on that.
But doesn't the footage that we saw about our own troops, sadly, in Vietnam or in the Iraqi conflict, end up giving you that sense that atrocities are part of war?
Oh, it's absolutely. Not even close, though. It's not even close because, you know, I mean, I hate to seem like a... I mean, I'm Canadian originally, so I'm not... although I'm a Vietnam veteran. But, you know, there's the idea of restraint in American force, unless it's from far away. Like, you know, you can drop bombs. Like, Tokyo, they actually killed more people in Hiroshima. They just thought, we can't find these factories. Let's just burn the whole city down. But, you know, the Japanese would find that appalling, but we would find it appalling that people do this one-on-one. And so, in a sense, you know, as God looks at it, we say, well, we're very moral. We may have burned cities down, but at least we don't bayonet people. Or, you know, they're all dead.
Interesting. Well, we got to keep moving. Talk about contrast title-wise, in a way, Little Miss Sunshine. Really, so far, we're kind of on a downward spiral into complete darkness here.
Now for the New Testament.
Okay.
Bring her on.
Tell me about Little Miss Sunshine.
Well, I don't know. It's just so delightful. I mean, there's so many great gags, you know, like the little beeping horn that wouldn't quit on the Volkswagen. I mean, there's just so many great things that happen. But to me, it was kind of like, I mean, we're getting into sort of, you know, folkways here, but the Emperor's New Clothes. You know, you go into that scene where all these little girls are dressed up like women, and I mean, it's the most appalling kind of prostitution in the world. I mean, it's just scary. And then here comes in Little Miss Sunshine, completely oblivious to all this, and her grandpa's giving her these dance moves, and she basically does a striptease, although she doesn't take her clothes off. So all the people who are putting on this show, you know, are appalled at, you know, what she's doing. But when you put her next to these little girls who are all made up, I mean, it's pretty clear who the innocent kid is.
She's a satire of the very thing that's happening.
Exactly.
They don't get
exactly.
it. Yeah. And not only that, but she is, as in Babel, she is the one who's mirroring back to everybody else what they're doing. They are exploiting themselves to a ridiculous degree for a kind of success that is not even necessarily worth pursuing. And once they stop and realize how threatened she is and start supporting her, they start getting a vision of a different kind of success that is much more worth our time and effort.
Exactly. It's about, you know, the main, the dad talking about, are you a winner? Got to be a winner, you know, and how everyone in the van was trying to be a winner, Steve Carroll and the son who wants to go in the Air Force and all of this. And like you said, once they stop and realize, okay, it's not about winning, at least that goal or the goal we would say.
Here's what's interesting. I see all the things that you see, but as so often happens when I go to a movie with one of my own children, and I walk out and start asking, what do you think's going on in this movie? They detest me within a few minutes because I saw this, but I see the whole exercise of this movie more cynical, actually. And I'm not alone. Listen to the opening line of the New York Times critique of this movie: the family that pops Prozac together stays together. But the family that piles into an old Volkswagen bus the color of a banana surely has more entertainment value. That's the center of this movie is unhappy relations at the bittersweet comedy of dysfunction. And she ends her review saying, there's a melancholy here that clings to this family, which, however triumphant and united, may well remain stuck in the national Hooversville located at the crossroads of hope and despair. In other words, if the bright moment of the film is the exploitation by her grandfather of an innocent child who does a bump and grind, if that's our best hope, give me Babel.
Yeah, but it's funny, though.
I just thought I'd say that to see what you guys would say.
I don't know. What I like...
Because I know everybody loves Little Miss Sunshine. And I'm not... I don't think I'm some kind of fundamentalist overreacting. I'm saying the philosophical construct of this movie is cynical.
But it depends on which character you're going to focus on. First time I saw it, I agreed with you.
Okay.
I came away going, oh, man, what a disastrous... What a terrible...
No, I didn't say it was disastrous, because like you, laughed through the disaster.
It was great. I loved everybody in it.
No. What I mean was, at the beginning... I thought that I was preoccupied with what this grandfather had done to his granddaughter.
Yeah.
The second time, I was thinking about the girl and what she was doing for her grandfather, as oblivious as she was. She was doing her best for him.
Sweet kid,
that's
innocent,
why she
represents
went out there.
Something wonderful.
And even
but she was exploited.
Yes, sadly, yes.
And that's the redemptive part of the story.
Well, I think, like so many...
I'm just asking.
Like
just
so many
so I
films...
Can again, I don't hate the movie.
Like so many films, the most interesting part to me would be the next chapter beyond the credits, which we don't get.
But, okay, the family. But the New York Times says the next chapter is going to be bittersweet between hope and despair. This family's locked in being the entertaining, dysfunctional, Prozac-ridden family.
But at least they're starting to listen to each other at the end of the film. I mean, there's some sort of connection that they realize.
Absolutely.
All right,
okay, now
you
you're talking about the redemptive
in my life.
There are, in the arc of the various stories, redemptive moments, for sure.
But you know what Andrew Greeley would say? You talked about him earlier. He would say it's not a happy ending, but it's a hopeful ending.
Okay.
Which is the way life is. You want a hopeful ending.
Well, and there's a hopefulness, too, in Greg Kinnear's development as a character.
Yeah.
From the complete lunatic positive thinker
to
the guy that recognizes, I can't keep thinking positively. This is nuts.
Well, he's a total failure, and his big hope to break through is he's got these success tapes.
Stefan can't stop laughing about this movie.
I can't help it. It's just funny.
Well, that's good. But see, to me, if you ask yourself, what are the best redemptive stories, I guess I would say this is a great redemptive story within the limits of hope, of a fairly hopeless view of reality. In other words, if you can't make it better, laugh about it. What's interesting about this story is that the little girl that played that girl is from a very conservative Christian family. And they made her wear the headsets in the van
because their parents refused to have her hear the obscenity.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if they were going to cast her in the film, they didn't want their daughter exploited by the filmmaker, except, of course, at the end of the movie. But anyway, I digress. Well, we'll come back to that. I'm sure the audience will want to string me up, and there are some nice rafters in this room, too, for that. So, because I mean, people love this movie, and in my own family, I'm in the minority on that one. The Queen.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's what's interesting. Talking about Sundance, I saw a movie by the same director, same writer, called Longford. It's going to be on HBO, for those of you that have cable. A much better film than The Queen. And is only going to be released on HBO, which shocked me. I saw Longford before I saw The Queen, so I unfortunately went into The Queen with very high expectations and came away, and I'm an Anglophile right here, admittedly, and I did not like this film. My husband is shocked and amazed because I felt that it did not get to anything deeper than the debate between new and old. You know, new and old ways of living, new and old ways of thinking about the world, and sort of a class differentiation. Whereas when you look at Longford, you're getting into truly what it means to be human. There's themes of forgiveness. There's themes of redemption in that movie. But no one's seen it, so can't talk about it. But I was disappointed in The Queen.
In the film, but how about what the belief system is?
I did see the belief system, that sort of sense of we're moving towards something new and the monarchy needs to shift, or should it shift, and that debate between Tony Blair and the Queen and what is the way that England will go forward, but it didn't seem very compelling or interesting to me. The film did not show me, it told me too much, and that didn't compel me into those beliefs.
Well, one definition of postmodernism that I heard is that it's beliefs about beliefs. And so here you have the Queen, who originally was, you know, the divine right of queens. But we believe that about her, but we don't believe she really is anything but a nice old lady with a handbag. You know, she's reduced to having no power at all, even though we believe she does.
I looked at it as much as a movie about Tony Blair as about the Queen. And because he becomes the audience's cipher, so to speak. We're looking through his eyes at the problem in front of him and how the Queen is making the problem worse. And then slowly we follow him into a very patient, very gracious journey of understanding, of trying to get her attention, listening to her for his own purposes at first. But the more he listens to her, the more he comes to understand that, you know, it's not just a bunch of crazy manners. I mean, at the beginning of the movie, he, his wife, all of us are laughing at the Queen and her rituals. But as he comes to understand that there was meaning here, there was order, there was design, there were reasons these things were developed, he comes to respect her, and so do we to some extent. I mean, the great example is when the people are demanding that the flag be lowered to half-mast in Diana's name, and the Queen says, look, you know, she's not even part of the royal family anymore, and we have never brought the flag down to half-mast even for the death of a king. What are we saying if we do this? Yeah. Things mean things, and we developed a meaning here, and you're asking us to toss away this meaning. I think the last shot of the film is a great image describing the whole split. Here's the Queen and Tony, who is now walking with her through the very structured maze of that garden, mm-hmm. and the dogs
yes.
are the ones that are bounding over the lines and just running yeah. through the bushes. That's a very critical comment about the contemporary British people.
One of the reviewers observed that the Queen was technically right to consider Diana no longer deserving of a royal funeral, but in terms of modern celebrity worship, Elizabeth was wrong. What is the significance of the deer, the buck, the crown that's being hunted and at the end is dead and being dressed? And the Queen goes down to see the skinning,
headless corpse, yeah.
the headless corpse. Very strong symbol, isn't it, of her recognition that the monarchy and the perception of royalty as having its place is being displaced with a more kind of democratic perception of the people actually hold the power.
I heard that interpretation, and that was my interpretation when I first saw
yeah.
it. I also heard a completely different interpretation.
Which was?
She was so inspired by the beauty and the grace of this animal that all of a sudden she remembered what it was like to be inspired by something beautiful. Hmm. And for the first time, she could realize what the people were feeling. And she was so grieved to see that dead animal that she realized that something needed to be done. And finally, she recognized that while she didn't have a symbol or a ritual she could do, she had to do something to give the people an expression of grief and loss for what they loved. Hmm. Totally different.
We're going to be back and go to the audience questions right after this, and also ask each of our panelists to real quickly say, if you take all these films together, what are they saying about life on planet Earth in the year 2006? We'll be back with more of the Killing News right after this. Thank you for listening to the Kindling's Muse. If this program sparks something in you, I invite you to participate at www.thekindlings.com. That's K-I-N-D-L-I-N-G-S. Share this program, tell a friend, or just leave a comment at www.thekindlings.com.